This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for April 2009. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings from the upcoming issue.
April is our translation issue, and we're going to hear Richard Siebert talk about the bizarre mystical poetry of Carinus Kuhlmann.
He himself is fairly convinced that he is the new Messiah.
And we're also going to speak with Forrest Gander about a poem he translated, and about translation in general.
That's the exciting thing, is trying to bring a different music into English.
This is the fourth year in a row that we've dedicated the entire April issue to translations, but this year we've gone sort of meta, because we actually have a translation of a translation, right, Don?
Yes, very meta, because it's a translation of a fictitious translation. There are these twins, Gabriel and Marcel Picaret. They were Belgian writers who edited a European avant-garde journal in the late 50s. These guys were almost like Siamese twins conceptually. They did everything together. Whatever they wrote and did, they signed under this joint signature they had. They were really inseparable in every way you can possibly imagine.
And the poem of theirs that we have was originally presented as if it were a translation of a work by a romantic landscape poet. And they attached a note to the poem, and part of the note reads, "The poem evokes the anguish of the poet as he remembers the great rural solitudes where he lived with his late beloved aunt." Would you say that's what it's about, Don?
It isn't related to that at all.
Right. It's called A Pedal Pusher Said to Me, and it's translated by Robert Archambault and Jean-Luc Garneau. And we'll read it as if we're twins, maybe. We sort of are.
As if we know what we're talking
about.
That's
right. You start.
All right. "A pedal pusher said to me, 'No Breikaiser, no Sterfput, a stepping and a stomping cretin-wise could drive a man to madness, just as no thousand orphas, all draped in damp peignoirs, doing their great cochera with the prima donna, of equisgat moda, of pak vast, of anu neck, each orpha in an evening gown, imploring of our pedal pusher to go a step and go a stomp all over yet again, with a thousand mops and a thousand sterfputs imploring them, the Breikaiser in me, the sterfput in me, the mop in me, the cochera in me, the paxvast in me,
the ananak in me, the ikuzegdamota in me, and all the stompers, the steppers, the mops, the evening gowns, and all the orphas, all the pedal pushers, the damp pinwas, the cretins, the prima donnas who beg, the cocheras, the ikuzegdamotas, the ananaks, and all the paxvast to step and to stomp for the sake of love, the great flowering love of a thousand pedal pushers.
Draped in damp peignoirs, will lead no Breikaiser, no Sterfput, no mop, no cochera, no paxivast, no anunek, no ikuzagetamoda.
To implore a man to madness.
And that is what a stepping and a stomping
Cretan wise, a pedal pusher said to me."
That's hard to read.
So this clearly is not a romantic poem, is it? I mean, why does somebody do this?
I guess around the same time as this work was being written, you have that historical moment of the death of the author, which we associate with Roland Barthes. But, you know, there's the idea that surrealism helped kill off the author, that there isn't an individual consciousness that exists in some romantic way on a raft, you know, with Huck Finn or something. But what's interesting about these particular guys is that they really were not individual authors. They apparently were incapable of individual authorship. So their life sort of went seamlessly with the thinking of this moment.
Yeah, and I love the way it exists with that note. You know, this is a sort of plangent, rural, romantic poem, and you expect to read about clouds and, you know, sheep gambling about, and then suddenly you get this thing with all these invented words and these crazy things you don't know what's going on, and you have to ask yourself, well, why does this exist with that note? And it exists is sort of as if to say, you know, poetry has gotten so far from life with these romantic stereotypical descriptions that we've got to wrench it back, and the only way to do that is just to shock people. As they say in their note, the translators say in their note, to return poetry to some of the pleasures of pure chant, pure rhyme.
Yeah, it's a kind of updated nostalgia, which I have to imagine in their case comes from their growing up together. You know, a nostalgia for their childhood, where maybe they had some kind of secret language that evolved into a language of poetry for them. It's sort of this dreamy quality of surrealism is an attachment to things that didn't exist, but you kind of wanted them to, yeah, just because you thought them up.
Yeah. Also in the April issue, we have a handful of short poems called Mantenares. I hope I'm pronouncing the Greek there correctly. If not, forgive me. It's a form of folk poetry from Crete, and that was a mantenare you just heard recorded by phone.
They're couplets, and they're composed in the 15-syllable line that's standard for folk poetry in Greek. And they're usually improvised by a poet. The remedoros is what they're called. At weddings, baptisms, funerals, occasions like that.
It may be a folk tradition, but nowadays people send them around as text messages, actually. And the Cretan version of poetry slams are what are called mantinata battles. The Rhymodoros often sings or half sings these poems with musical accompaniment, which often includes a lyre. It's kind of the
musical instrument.
That's right. Yeah, it's like our version of poetry, our rap contest, right off the dome piece. You know, as they're making these things up.
Well, we're listening to Yorgos Vitoros, the mayor of Kirparisi, read some mantenades he and others wrote. They were selected and translated for the April issue by A.E. Stallings and Nick Papandreou, whose father and grandfather were both prime ministers of Greece.
And here's that first one that we heard in Greek. This is by Yorgos Vitoros, the mayor of Kirparisi. Whose garden are you blossomed to? To whom do you belong? Whose velvet down? Whose feather are you? Whose rejoicing song? A lot of them are like this. They're romantic. They can be love poems, but then some can be quite different. They can sort of turn love poems on their head.
Yeah, there's like this one from Yanis Pavlakis' Cretan folk poetry collection. I want my darling filthy. It's the dirty girl I trust to keep her to myself and make the rest flee in disgust.
And then he changes gears immediately, and the very next one that he writes is, there is a sheer cliff at the end of the footpath of our lives, but he whose soul possesses wings unfurls them and survives.
Here's one from the 6,000 couplets of Aristides Charetis. If I'd saved all the tears from when I first began to weep, I'd have a sea by now, and I could float upon the deep. Imagine people texting this stuff back and forth.
Well, you know, they don't always text. Sometimes they, as our translators mentioned in their note, sometimes they will call each other up on the phone, and the way that the conversation will initiate is just with a volley of rhymes back and forth, and they're each trying to outdo each other right when they call each other up. One of these poets says he can only write when there's strong opposition in the house from another rhymester. So it's like the Picarades. They're playing off each other. It's clearly some sort of group dynamics going on, right? There's not some singular genius creating these things.
Yeah, it's really true, and it's an obsessive dynamic at that.
Auf Nacht, Dunst, Schlacht, Frost, Wind, See, Hitz, Süd, Ost, West, Nord, Sonn, Feuer und Plagen, Volk, Tag, Glanz, Blut.
That is Richard Siebert reading a poem by the 17th century German poet Carinus Kuhlmann.
Kält, Licht, Brand und Not.
You could probably tell, even if you don't speak German, that the poem is made up almost entirely of monosyllabic words, one after the other.
Richard Siebert says that the idea is that the poem can act as a kind of poem-generating device, which generates countless new combinations of this monosyllabic stem word, one after the other, one following another.
In fact, it seems that he was thinking of creating a kind of wooden poem wheel, almost like a Tibetan prayer wheel on which you would possibly run this poem through. So it's an early form of a kind of a computer-like poetry coming out of medieval theories of numerology and cosmology. Frucht, Asch, Dach, Teich, Feld, Wies und Brot. Think about Kabbalah also in terms of generating out of the very structure of the word the deep structure of the universe.
Kuhlmann was a colorful figure, and he lived, like we do, during very unsettled times.
He himself is fairly convinced that he is the new Messiah. He refers to himself as Jezuel, and he later makes his way to Moscow in an attempt to bring the Tsar into this same conspiratorial league against popery, and dies tortured and burnt at the stake for heresy in Moscow.
Let's hear Kuhlmann's poem again, this time in English. It comes from a series of poems called Love Kiss, and this is number 41, which is called The Mutability of Human Affairs.
From night, fog, clash, frost, wind, sea, heat, south, east, west, north, sun, fire, and plagues, come day, blaze, bloom, snow, peace, land, flash, warmth, heat, joy, cool, light, flames, and dread. From ache, pain, shame, fear, war, oh, cross, stress, scorn, hurt, shock, guile, scold, and fraud, come joy, charm, fame, ease, wins, truce, gains, peace, jokes, games, rest, mild, morning rays. The moon, beam, smoke, buck, fish, gold, pearl, tree, flame, stork, frog, lamb, ox, all at play, love sheen, straw, steam, peak, flood, glow, foam, fruit, ash, roof, pool, field, wheat and bread. The guard, man, work, strain, art, play, ship, mouth, prince, rage, care, greed, faith, and God, seek, goal, sleep, praise, prize, luck, strife, port, kiss, throne, death, shroud, gold, thanks to say, what good, strong, hard, right, long, great, white, one, yea, air, fire, high, wide, should be named, with care, bad, weak, plain, bent, broad, small, black, three, nay, earth, flood, deep, to avoid, lest pluck, love, wise, wit, mind, soil, friend, joy, grace, fame, peace, play, praise, be destroyed, where fear, hate, lies, wine, meat, flesh, foe, woe, shame, angst, strife, pain, rule the day. All things do change, all things do love, all things are locked in hate. Whoever fully thinks this through holds the key to man's estate.
We had to print this thing out on a special fold-out page because it's so strange-looking.
It's got a note of, from the poet actually on the back, which is printed in very small type, and it's a very modest note. He says, "Oh, come join up with me, all you practitioners of wisdom. Why would all of you dimwits want to peer into mere hollowness of appearance? Sharpen your perceptions. Consider the inner essence of such miraculous transmutations," and it goes on from there. And so we're meant to experience in this poem somehow the creation of the universe, which I don't, actually. But
well, in theory, it's possible because you have this almost infinite capability for permutation, so that in this poem, for instance, using the 13 words in each line, you can achieve, let's see if I can get this right, 622,720,800 variations just from the words in one line of the poem alone.
And then
so it just
goes on from there, right?
It goes on from there.
It's completely out of control, right?
Right, right. You know, so it's like being unable to count or contain the number of grains of sand in the world, something like that.
Yeah, it's a feat. And if you read it the way that he suggests, you take the first word of each line, the last two words, I believe it is, or last, yeah, last two words of each line, and you can then substitute any word in there. So if I just take the last stanza like that, and I do the beginning and the end of each, I can read it, what good should be named with care to avoid, lest pluck be destroyed where fear rule the day. And there's a little compressed bit of wisdom there.
Yes, well, he even talks about that. He talks about precious pearls of wisdom that people toss aside when they start quarreling about what he calls, you know, mere baubles of glass, you know, things that have more appeal than their deepest essences. Because there's something literally Platonic behind all this. You know, if you understand numbers, that is their innermost being, you understand everything.
Yeah. The effect of the poem It's as if you're staring into something that's far beyond your power, say creation. And that's what
right. The poem, yeah. And you learn as you proceed, he says in the note.
And you'd never guess it, or you might not have guessed it. Some careful listener might have guessed it. But this poem is actually a sonnet, and a very rare form of the sonnet.
It is one of the weirdest, strangest sonnets ever written in our tradition. Its rhyme scheme is ABCA, ABCA, ADDA, EE. This is a kind of a sonnet that no one's ever heard of. It's an ecstatic sonnet machine, an ecstatic sonnet machine.
Siebert was first turned on to Kuhlmann by the filmmaker Werner Herzog, who thinks that he's one of the great poets in the German tradition.
If I try to imagine him in my mind, I see him somewhat like a figure like Herzog's Kaspar Hauser. There's a kind of autistic yet visionary quality to his entire poetry.
Poet Forrest Gander has just completed a book of translations of the work of Mexican poet Corral Bracho. He's now translating the work of another Mexican poet, Pura López Colomé.
It's from that work in progress that we get Forrest's translation of the poem Echo. Forrest joins us from a studio in Providence, where he's a professor at Brown University. Hi, Forrest.
Hi, Don. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how you doing, Forrest? We're going to ask you to read the poem from the April issue that you translated, but first of all, I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about Pura López Colomé.
Sure thing. She's a poet outside of Mexico City in Cuernavaca who grew up in the Yucatan, which has its own linguistic dialect. And her last book, Santo Ysenia, won the big Mexico poetry prize, the Villa Urrutia, in 2007.
And her poem is called Echo. Is there anything that would be helpful for our listeners to know before you read it?
Her poem seems to take place during a time when she's undergoing physical trauma, which is cancer. And in this poem, she's sort of slipping under a narcotic before some kind of treatment or operation. And in the last moments of consciousness, what's going through her mind is a poem of Emily Dickinson's.
The poem has an epigraph from Emily Dickinson, and the epigraph runs, "It would not sound so deep were it a firmamental product airs no oceans keep." So here is Forrest Gander reading Echo by Pura López Colomé.
Afloat between your lens and your gaze, the last consideration to go across my gray matter and its salubrious deliquescence is whether or not I'll swim, whether I'll be able to breathe, whether I'll live like before. I'm caught in the bubble of your breath. It locks me in, drives me mad. Confined to speak alone, I talk and listen, ask questions and answer myself. I hum, I think, I sing. I breathe in, and don't explode. I'm no one. Behind the wall of hydrogen and oxygen, very clear, almost illuminated, you allow me to think that the root of the wind is water, and the atmosphere smells of salt and microbes and intimacy. And in that instant comes the low echo of a beyond beyond, a language archaic and soaked in syllables and accents suited for re-detransforming, giving light, giving birth to melanin hidden within another skin, the hollow echo of the voice, which speaks alone.
That was Echo by Pura López Colomé and translated by Forrest Gander. Forrest, I wonder if you can tell us just a little bit about how Emily Dickinson sort of works her way into this poem.
Well, Pura López Colomé can recite Thomas Hardy endlessly, Dickinson endlessly, Seamus Heaney endlessly, as well as Goethe in German. She's extremely well-read, and herself is composed in part of the sort of selving of all the different poets that she's read. And in this moment of confrontation with her own mortality, it's Dickinson that is haunting her, whose words are the last thing in her consciousness to go before she goes under this narcotic. And that brings on this sort of meditation about the presence of voices inside other people, the, you know, multiple presences. And in the end of the poem, we have the sense that there's just a solitary voice, but we don't know if it's the author's voice, Pura Lopez Colomé's, or Emily Dickinson's voice that's finally what's there.
Now, you're a poet yourself, a wonderful poet, and you just finished a novel of your own, a novel which we're actually reviewing in our May issue of Poetry Magazine.
Wow,
and
great.
I wonder if you could tell us, does translation feel like it's a very distinct type of work for you, or does it tap into the same kind of work rhythms that poetry and fiction do?
Well, it's interesting that you use that word rhythm, because that's the principal thing that seems to be different, is that you hear a different kind of music than the music that you generally work with as a poet. And that's the exciting thing, is trying to bring a different music into English than you work with. But every trick that you've learned as a poet comes to bear, and other things come to bear, tricks that you haven't learned as a poet that you need to learn to bring this new work out into a language that it wasn't written in. There's also a sublimation of the self, what you would ordinarily do, and an intensification of a listening into, that phrase that Miles Davis used to use, that he didn't just listen, but listened into, that I think makes translation happen.
You know, about 100 years ago, just when Poetry Magazine was getting started, Ezra Pound could say that he thought American poetry was provincial, which was one reason why he put so much energy into his own weird translations, you know, from Italian and Chinese and everything else. Do you think American poetry is still provincial, or do we live in some kind of age of translation now?
I think really during the Bush administration, when we had a president that wasn't so interested in reading or other cultures or other languages, and we, you know, launched into several wars, that people became more intensely interested in other cultures and in translation, and that in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of attention to it. What it does is refresh American language with different rhythms and imagistic patterns and perceptions that take place in other languages and that transform English when they're translated into English and refresh our language.
Unfortunately, I think there's a kind of thrust away from the idea of great poets in any language. And so we pay the price for that on the one hand, because you don't want to see a lot of poems that sound like Rilke, which you did for a very long time. But now these things have slipped away. On the other hand, it seems like there are translators doing all kinds of unusual poetry from all over the world, which you didn't see so much before in a time when everybody wanted to translate the same handfuls of poets from around the world.
So I think it may be, you know, surging, though. I mean, if we think of all the Celan translations in the last 10 years, you know, there's lots of different people that have been translating Celan, and that this strange French, you know, poet, Edmond Jabez, that so many of his books were translated into English, and that, like, next year, this Chilean poet, Raul Zurita, is going to have 3 new books translated into English. I mean, you see in Steve Burt's work, for instance, a young poet, the influence of Latin American poetry, contemporary Latin poetry, and in someone like Susan Briante, who lives in Texas, you see the influence of translation, and Pragita Sharma reading Korean women poets and being influenced by those. Crossing borders seems to be the major metaphor of, you know, the 21st century, and that crossing borders is all about translation. I think more and more it's going to govern the fields of thought in the 21st century.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Forrest.
What a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
You can read Forrest Gander's translation of Echo and everything else you've heard on this program in the April issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman, edited by Sarah Campbell, and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The music in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherr.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.